Welcome to Talk Nation Radio. I'm Dori Smith. Today we'll hear part one of a lecture given by journalist Dar Jamail at ECSU, Eastern Connecticut State University in Willimantic, Connecticut. He spoke before a crowd of several hundred students, professors, and members of the general public on September 21, 2009, at an event marking the UN's International Day of Peace. The program was sponsored by Promoting Enduring Peace and Campus Groups. We'll link to the video of this event, including a lively Q&A, at talknationradio.org. And you can learn more about Dar Jamail's recent book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refused to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, at his website, dar.org, D-A-H-R.org, or at the publisher, Haymarket Books. Dar Jamail's previous book was Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq.
I hope to assume correctly that everybody in this room is aware of that, you know, the invasion of Iraq was based completely on lies. And the so-called journalism that took place in this country during the lead-up to that war was so atrocious that if we had had anything like real journalism happening in that time, then I would, I think, comfortably argue that the war probably never should have ever taken place, because the justifications given to use for the invasion held no water, never did, and never will. And I think that anyone with a pulse at this point of the game should be aware of that if you've read much at all. Weapons of mass destruction that never existed and never will. Links to September 11 between Saddam Hussein never existed and never will. And certainly the other big lie of that this was about liberating the Iraqi people and somehow this dignified attempt of helping improve their lives, of course, that never existed and never will. That's not what this is all about. But we, of course, were fed through most, again, with few exceptions. There were a few notable exceptions, but in most of the media, we had, you know, on the CNNs and the Fox and the CBS, ABC, NBC, the NPRs, for the most part, had just kind of this mindless repetition of what the government was saying, you know, and for those who aren't familiar with it, for example, I think, you know, one of the key mechanisms used to sell the war was the infamous stories of so-called journalist Judith Miller with the New York Times, who would go visit Cheney or some of his people and be fed this information. Oh, yes, we're absolutely sure that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. And then she would, of course, have the lead story in the New York Times, the most prestigious paper and most widely circulated paper in the country, and then run the story. And then Cheney would go on his Sunday morning talk shows and cite the New York Times for evidence of backing up his argument that, yes, Iraq does have indeed weapons of mass destruction. So is that really journalism? Or is that really basically being a state stenographer? Or, you know, basically just, you know, sitting there with your notepad and listening to what Dick Cheney or his aides tell you and then writing that as hard news? Well, I would argue confidently that that's not journalism whatsoever. You're basically being a pawn for the state. You're being a state stenographer, literally. And I think that that, unfortunately, was not uncommon of so much of the media in this country, this hysteria and this fear of, well, yeah, we have to have this war because otherwise we're going to have mushroom clouds and this kind of thing, just total hysteria, and none of it based on any kind of fact whatsoever, i.e., that's not journalism whatsoever. There's an Israeli journalist named Amira Haas, who has spent the brunt of her career as an Israeli working in Palestine, reporting on how Israeli government policies are actually affecting the Palestinian people. She's a very good journalist, does really excellent work, and she has a famous quote that she said about basically what her ideal is of what journalism should be. And Amira Haas says, we as journalists, it's our job to monitor the centers of power. And so when you compare that ideal, that means basically sitting down with a George Bush or a Barack Obama or insert name of person with political power here and sitting down with them and asking them really, really hard questions. And then when they try to evade the question, you repeat the question. And when they try to evade it again, you repeat it again. And that's how it goes. That's called hard journalism. And instead of that, we have, you know, the people that show up at the press conferences and that get the front row seats for the most part that ask the big, throw out the big softball questions for people. And that's just not journalism. You're not going to reveal anything. You're not going to uncover anything big doing journalism in that way. So I decided to go over to Iraq and see what was happening myself because of my outrage at the so-called media coverage during the lead up to the war. And then, of course, also because of the embedded program with the U.S. military. And I want to give a brief history of the embed program. Embedding with military units is not new. It actually happened as far back as World War II and even in some instances in World War I. But we can talk about the new version of the embed program as really starting during the 91 Gulf War, because the Pentagon realized one thing they needed to change after Vietnam was we can't have these little pesky journalists running around, hopping on helicopters and going out and reporting on whatever they want to report on, because they're going to show some things that we really don't want them to see. For example, like in Vietnam, as you've probably read, we had pretty regular images of wounded soldiers, sometimes dead soldiers, wounded and dead Vietnamese civilians. And that's not good for the Pentagon that wants to keep prosecuting a war, because that starts to turn people, big shocker, that starts to turn people against war. When they start to really see the toll it really takes on human beings, then people kind of start to lose the appetite for war. When they start seeing, you know, just very cursorily, some of these very, very mild images that are scrolling up here, like, this is what war does to people's lives. It displaces people. It makes things like potable water and electricity not available for people. It kills lots of civilians. It causes lots of suffering. And even with the people in the military itself, it kills people. It wounds people. They have severe psychological damage that they then have to try to sort out for the rest of their lives. So this is not, you know, war is not pretty. It's vile, disgusting, terrible. It's a nightmare. And if journalists accurately report on war, then this is not going to help the Pentagon's cause, who, of course, are under instructions from the U.S. government to prosecute war. So they developed this thing called the embed program, and the modern iteration of it was they tried it out during the 1991 U.S. attack on Iraq, and it basically took journalists and embedded them literally with the unit that they were going to go around with and file stories from. And you kind of got this short, very brief kind of basic training of, like, this is how you put on a flak jacket and helmet, and, you know, when incoming fire happens, you know, so kind of like a little rough reporter boot camp, if you will. And it kind of was part of this indoctrination process that they do with the troops themselves. You know, you have to band with your unit, you have to watch each other's backs, this kind of thing. And so, and it was very effective also because of, obviously, if a reporter's going around with a unit, especially during an invasion, which would be a very scary thing, you're relying on all these people around you for your life. They have to succeed, or you're not A, going to file the story, and B, or you're not going to get out in one piece. So obviously this camaraderie is going to form, and i.e., guess what? Your coverage of that unit is going to be very favorable for obvious reasons. So that's embedded reporting, and basically what it meant was that mostly during the 91 Gulf War, we didn't see much coverage at all of the over 100,000 Iraqis that were wiped out in that very short period of time, just during the initial war, not even talking about the sanctions. We didn't see the bodies, you know, burned alive in their cars that were driving on the roads and they were hit by U.S. airstrikes. We didn't see the bombed electrical plants and the bombed water treatment plants and things like this. We saw very sterile images, black and white images of missiles going down the chimneys of certain buildings or down the air ducts of certain buildings and the so-called surgical strikes and this kind of thing. So we saw this kind of really sterile version of war. It was precise. It was surgical. We were only hitting military targets. We weren't hitting any civilians, this kind of thing. And that's basically a product of embedded reporting. And it was so successful that over 90% of the journalists, I think it was 91% of the journalists that embedded in 91, went back and did it again. So the Pentagon was thrilled. Okay, we have this big success. So we're going to really augment it. And then now with the 2003 war, we're going to really, really push this. And basically, that's what we saw during the 2003 invasion was total embedded reporting. You know, we saw Geraldo Rivera riding up with a platoon and you know, bringing people along for the exciting invasion, and you know, and reporters with their arms around troops and celebrating the success with the troops. And, you know, in my view, that's just not journalism. That's not reporting on both sides. That's not reporting on how this was affecting the civilian population of Iraq. And it actually wasn't even accurate reporting of the soldiers themselves. And I'll get into that next, because that's basically what my new book is about, is so what is it like then to be in the military and be a grunt and be a soldier that's following these orders and being ordered in to do these things like home raids, or being ordered to interrogate people, or being ordered to keep people awake for 5 days straight before they will be interrogated. Let's talk to those guys. And so that's really what I tried to do with this current book, The Will to Resist. The theme of the book is basically about what's happening in the military as a result of both of these ongoing, unending occupations of both Iraq and Afghanistan. And so I want to just start with giving you a little bit of context for why is there now resistance in the military against both these occupations. And I know that for most of you, this is probably a new story. You've probably not heard of it. You probably think it's a very isolated thing, and it's not happening very much. So before I get into resistance that is happening, because it is quite widespread, it's just mostly covert, that coupled with the fact that, of course, most of the mainstream media won't touch this topic, but that, of course, doesn't mean that it's not happening. So I want to start with just giving you a little bit of context for what's happening in the U.S. military as a direct result of both of these occupations. So far, we've had over 2 million soldiers cycle through both Iraq and Afghanistan. Surpassed only by average Iraqis, members of the U.S. military who have been deployed to both occupations are paying the highest price both while in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as when they come back home. They are now part of an unfortunate, tragic segment of U.S. society that has been maligned and tossed aside, neglected, forgotten. Today, more U.S. war veterans are killing themselves than are dying in open combat while overseas. 1,000 veterans who are receiving care from the Department of Veterans Affairs, the VA, are attempting suicide every single month, and 18 veterans kill themselves every single day. The deeper one digs, the more apparent it becomes that the military is in a state of near collapse. For years now, one retired general after another has appeared in the media to denounce the occupation of Iraq, and now more recently are starting to with Afghanistan, and to expose what both occupations are doing to single-handedly destroy the U.S. military. With the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan, more than 565,000 troops have been deployed more than once. By December 2006, it was estimated that 50% of troops in Iraq were serving their second tour, and another 25% were on their third or fourth tour. We can dramatically increase those numbers now. The military is so overstretched that troops being redeployed often have traumatic brain injury, TBI, from surviving roadside bombs in previous deployments, and more than 43,000 troops listed as medically unfit have been deployed anyway. Soldiers already diagnosed with PTSD and other severely debilitating mental health conditions that accompany it are being redeployed as the military dredges up troops to keep enough boots on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan. By October 2007, the Army reported that approximately 12% of combat troops in Iraq were coping by taking antidepressants or sleeping pills. We also have another phenomenon that's happening where the military, they've basically thrown their usual criteria of this is kind of where the bar is that you have to pass in order to join the military. They basically have lowered it and lowered it and lowered it. And that means from increasing the age at which they'll take new recruits to up to 42, so lucky me, I can go join the military now if I want to, on up to you know, the allowable weight limit for a man or a woman. They've increased that. If you have some physical problems or mental problems, they've even lowered the criteria to allow in more of these folks. And I think, you know, more shockingly, we have a situation where the military now is allowing in people with criminal records. So we have known rapists serving in both Iraq and Afghanistan. We have over 8,000 people serving in Iraq with rap sheets, i.e. criminal records. We have gang members. We have thieves. These are people now serving in both occupations. And so what does that do to the morale of the people who we refer to as lifers in the military, of people who join because they want to serve and defend the Constitution and protect their country, and they want to spend their lives in the military, and they love being in the military, and they take a lot of pride in that, and then you put them right next to some gangsters or maybe a rapist, and you know, so what's that going to do to morale? It's not going to be real helpful, and that's starting to take its toll, obviously. Other things that we see happening in the military that are causing big problems, and this is not new. I'm reporting on this, and there's a few other people reporting on it too, and it's an ongoing increasing problem, is a problem with rape and sexual assault in the U.S. military. I have a chapter in the book called Resisting Sexism, because it's so rampant in the military. And when I talk about this, I always like to share two really important statistics that if you're a woman and you're thinking of joining the military, or if you know of any women thinking of joining the military, you really need to know these two statistics before you do so. One, according to the VA, 20% of all female soldiers treated by the VA report having been raped or sexually assaulted in the military. 20%, pretty high number. 1 in 5 chance that, you know, that's going to happen to you, which, you know, not the greatest odds. Another figure I want to hold up comes from the Pentagon, and it shows that 80% of all rapes and sexual assaults in the military never get reported. So, and there's a lot of other statistics we can point to show a very, very extreme rate of rape and sexual assault in the military, but just holding these two up together by themselves, 20% being raped according to the VA or sexually assaulted, and then 80% never getting reported, add those together. If I'm a woman and I'm thinking of joining the military, I think I probably wouldn't, because you just about have 100% chance of being raped or sexually assaulted. And that's exactly what I found when I talked to all the women that are in this book, and obviously most of them that are in the chapter on resisting sexism in the military. And to give you an idea of how bad this is, and again, generally this is not the type of information that you're going to see on CNN or read about in the New York Times. In fact, the New York Times recently did, about 3 weeks ago, a big story on women in the military and kind of the struggles they're up against as far as, well, yes, it's very competitive and we have to compete with the men and we're very outnumbered and then there's the physical disadvantage, whatever. So it really focused on kind of bogus things like this, and it dedicated an entire paragraph to rape and sexual assault in the military and was kind of dismissive of it, of like, well, yeah, this does happen from time to time and it's a bit of a problem, but the military is actually trying to deal with it. So I want to read you a little bit, just briefly, from the book about this topic. The first person that I want to talk to you about, her name is April Fitzsimmons. She actually didn't serve in Iraq or Afghanistan. I do have several people in the chapter who were raped in Iraq, and I do go into detail about their stories. But April Fitzsimmons served in the Air Force from 1985 to 1989 as an intelligence analyst and an intelligence briefer for a 2-star general. Early in her military career, she was sexually assaulted by another soldier. She went on to tell me of her experience, quote, "When victims come forward, they are ostracized, doubted, and isolated from their communities. They are punished. Many of the perpetrators are officers who use their ranks to coerce women to sleep with them. On being asked, all they have to do is deny it, after which they are reprimanded and sent away. It's a closely interwoven community, so the perpetrators are safe within the system and can fearlessly move free amongst their victims. The crisis is so severe that I'm telling women to simply not join the military because it's completely unsafe and puts them at risk. Until something changes at the top, no woman should join the military." I actually called the Pentagon recently because I'm doing another story on this, a follow-up story, because the crisis is worsening. And I asked them, what are they doing to try to alleviate the problem of rape and sexual assault in the military? And the FLAC, the public affairs officer, the Pentagon spokesperson that I spoke with, said, well, yeah, we've got this new agenda. We're going to do these new trainings, et cetera. And it was, you know, there's a lot of stuff on their website that she pointed me to. And then she said, but really, essentially, we're asking people to watch each other's backs. So not exactly a real effective policy to really change things. Now I want to shift gears and talk about a woman named General Janice Karpinski. I met her in January 2006 in New York City. We were both at a commission of inquiry for crimes against humanity committed by the Bush administration, specifically regarding the invasion and occupation of Iraq. Karpinski was the former commander of Abu Ghraib prison. She made one of the most shocking revelations that it was by the order of Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, the former senior U.S. military commander in Iraq, that the cause of death of several female American soldiers in Iraq had been covered up. Karpinski testified that a coalition joint task force surgeon said in a briefing that women soldiers had died of dehydration in the 130-degree heat. Abu Ghraib prison is right on the northern outskirts of Baghdad, so obviously in the summer it gets insanely hot there. The women refused to drink liquids in the latter part of the day because they were reluctant to use the latrines, which were located outside their barracks, after dark, for fear of being sexually assaulted or raped by male soldiers. Generators at the camp were loud enough to muffle the sound of the women's screams as male soldiers jumped them and dragged them and sexually assaulted them. Speaking of Lieutenant General Ricardo S. Sanchez, who was commander of coalition forces in Iraq from June 03 to June 04, Karpinski said, quote, "Rather than make everybody aware of that, because that's shocking, and as a leader, if that's not shocking to you, then you're not much of a leader, what they told the surgeon is don't brief those details anymore. And don't say specifically that they're women. You can provide that in a written report, but don't brief it in the open anymore," end quote. She earlier, just before that testimony, speaking at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law down in San Diego, California, about sexual assaults in Iraq and their cover-up, and she said, quote, "It was out of control. An 800 number existed as a helpline for women to use to report sexual assaults, but no one had a phone, and no one answered the number, which was based in the United States." She informed the audience that after more than 80 incidents were reported during a six-month period in Iraq and Kuwait, the rape hotline was still being answered by a machine that told callers to leave a message. Quote, "There were innumerable such situations all over the theater of operations, Iraq and Kuwait, because female soldiers didn't have a voice individually or collectively. Even as a general, I didn't have a voice with Sanchez, so I know what the soldiers were facing. Sanchez did not want to hear about female soldier requirements and or issues." Karpinski quoted Sanchez as saying, "The women asked to be here, so now let them take what comes with the territory." So we can see very clearly there's a very big problem in the military, whether we talk about resisting sexism or resisting homophobia or the fact that people coming back are not getting the treatment that they need. Let me talk a little bit more about that, because as I said, we've had well over 2 million now U.S. soldiers that have been cycled through both Iraq and Afghanistan. And there was a RAND Corporation report that came out. RAND Corporation is a military-affiliated think tank with the Army. And they had a report that came out relatively recently that showed 300,000 soldiers from both occupations have come back home with severe post-traumatic stress disorder and or severe depression. And what's happening with these people when they come back home, and some of this, you may have seen some flashes of this in the mainstream media, they're not getting the treatment that they need. So, you know, there's all this hubbub about support the troops, but the reality is when a soldier comes back from Iraq or Afghanistan, and if they don't have a life-threatening ailment, a casualty, like if they're literally not like bleeding out from some wound, if they have instead a lesser physical injury that they can still kind of manage in their life but do still need treatment for, or more commonly if they have psychological problems from severe post-traumatic stress disorder, and if you want to go get help at the Veterans Administration, you have on average a six-month wait. That's best case scenario. A lot of the people I talked with in this book would say, yeah, so I'm supposed to sit there for 6 months. I have insomnia because I'm having nightmares. I'm waking up sometimes like fighting something, whether it's my girlfriend or my wife, or, you know, I'm grinding my teeth at night. I'm thinking about killing myself. And the VA tells me I get to wait 6 months before I can see a counselor. And then another guy I talked with in the book, Christopher Goldsmith, he talked about how when he finally did get into the VA and did get to see a counselor, the one-hour counseling session looked like him and 25 other service members or their family members sitting in a room with one counselor asking the counselor questions. That was his treatment. So there is a crisis in the VA. They're underfunded, they're understaffed, and they just don't have what they need to give soldiers, this massive number of soldiers that need treatment. In fact, over 1 million claims have been filed by soldiers that they haven't even been able to respond to yet. Over 1 million that people have filed, I need this help, I need this counseling, I need this medication, whatever it is, and the VA literally hasn't been able to even get back to them and say, okay, well, we got your claim, and you know, we'll have an appointment for you in 6 months. I've talked to some people who had to wait 3 years to actually get seen by the VA. So as a result, then we have people coming back, people like a guy I know at Fort Hood, Texas. I was just there a few weeks ago. His name's Michael Kern. He's an active duty member based at Fort Hood in Texas, the biggest base in the country, the most heavily deployed base in the country. And he is a combat vet from Iraq, and he was very open, shared. I have 6 discs full of his videos and photos that he shot in Iraq, illustrating graphically horrendous things that he and his platoon and other platoons did, from home raids to killing civilians to all kinds of other fun things. And Kern has severe post-traumatic stress disorder. He has traumatic brain injury, which is basically a huge concussion that you get when you're in a Humvee and a roadside bomb goes off, and the air concussion basically slaps your brain against one side of your skull. And so it causes pretty severe memory loss. You'll be talking to him and he'll start a sentence and then forget what he just said, and being unable to. This is really, really common with people with TBI. And as I just said, you know, there's tens of thousands of troops now. It's actually over 40,000 that have been sent back to one occupation or another that have been diagnosed with TBI, and yet they're being sent back on the front lines anyway. But Michael Kern told me, you know, after showing me literally this basket that he keeps beside his bed of pill bottles, because he was on a dozen different kinds of medications. He was still active duty, because the military, even though they diagnosed him with PTSD and TBI, and he was still active duty because they were still wanting to try to send him, actually this time now, back over to Afghanistan. A few weeks ago, I also spoke with a guy up in Alaska who was diagnosed with a brain tumor that obviously needed to be operated on. The military knew this, and they tried to send him to Iraq with a brain tumor, telling him, well, you can get that worked on after you go do a deployment. I met another guy who was diagnosed with severe post-traumatic stress disorder, and the military gave him medications and said, okay, we know you have PTSD. Here are these meds. They should help you sleep a little bit better at night. Go to Iraq and you can get more treatment there. So this is how desperate the military is to find basically boots on the ground. And then now we're talking about, this kind of brings us up to speed of, so what is going to happen with Afghanistan? There's going to be 69,000 U.S. troops there by the end of this year. General Stanley McChrystal is the U.S. general in charge of all NATO and U.S. forces in that country. And he is now in a position where he's asking Obama for more troops. And this is all, you know, kind of the big headlines right now, today, the last few days, and I think will be for the next couple of weeks. Because now, you know, there's this report out from him basically showing, look, things are very, very severe in Afghanistan. It's basically a report to try to justify the fact that he's about to ask for what's probably going to be between 20 and 40,000 more troops for Afghanistan. Not a real popular thing. 56% of the people in this country now oppose what's happening in Afghanistan, so they have to kind of tread lightly and try to do this the right way. But what this means is, where are they going to get these troops? Because there's still over 131,000 U.S. forces in Iraq. All the leading generals there say they'll be about that same number at least halfway through 2010. So they can't just like take folks from Iraq and send them over to Afghanistan. So where are they going to get this 20 to 40,000 troops? We're seeing guys that are on their second, third, fourth, fifth, sometimes sixth deployments now in Iraq, and sometimes even in Afghanistan.
That was journalist Dar Jamail speaking at Eastern Connecticut State University in Willimantic, September 21, 2009. You can learn more about the impact of the Iraq and Afghan wars on U.S. military personnel serving in them at his website, dahr.org. In part two of this program, we'll hear more about U.S. soldiers who are refusing to deploy to Iraq or Afghanistan on grounds that the wars are illegal and amoral, and because they feel incapable of further service due to war injuries. Soldiers are being pressured, threatened, or even incarcerated and stripped of health care and other benefits as punishment. Dar Jamil writes about them in his new book, The Will to Resist: Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut. Our website is talknationradio.org. Write to us at talknationradio@gmail.com.